You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 8th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
You guys gearing up for our extravaganza events coming up? Like, the rest of the year is already booking up so fast.
Oh, there's so much coming up.
Absolutely. I have to make a quickie announcement, Steve.
We had to change
the date of the QED SGU private show. It is now going to be on Friday night, not Saturday night.
What is the date of that?
That would be Friday the 12th.
October 12th. Friday, October 12th is when that show is going to happen, not Saturday the 13th.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and the extravaganza is on Thursday the 11th.
Right. It's getting a little confusing, but yes, you're correct,
Steve. You can get tickets for the extravaganza. There is separate tickets for the private show. We will be doing a live show at QED, I believe, on that Saturday. And then there'll be other stuff going on as well, when the QED full schedule comes out. And we're also selling tickets to our DragonCon private show, which is on Saturday, September 1st.
Right. Just go to theskepticsguide.org. In the navigation on the top, you'll see a link for event, the word event in the navigation, and then the three things are there. I have another quickie cool announcement. We are redoing the SGU website.
Woohoo!
All right.
Yep, a project that I've been wanting to do for a very long time. You know, I don't want to give a launch date because why? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like when it's done, it's done. but I will announce it on the show probably within the next 8 weeks.
I'm looking at the site right now and I love the picture that was chosen for the tickets to the SGU private show at DragonCon. I love seeing pictures that are like snapshots in time of us, especially on panels, because I'm like, what was being said right then?
Yeah.
Like Steve's laughing. I'm talking or I'm looking incredulous. Evan's looking incredulous too. Steve and Jay are laughing and Bob's sort of looking down.
Yeah.
I think Bob was talking.
Well, I have a video of that event. We could find out exactly
what that moment in time was.
Something clearly is bothering you or something, right?
I don't know. Yeah, it looks like it. Oh, I love it.
We have a great show to get on to. We have Sean Carroll coming on later in the show. But Kara, you're going to start us off with what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week, I'm going to be 100% honest. I checked my email and nobody within my email recommended this word. It may have come through on social media. I think I came up with it on my own, but who knows? This is a word that I use quite often in my psychology research and social science research and statistics, but it has a lot of definitions. So the word is orthogonal. We've used it quite a few times on the show, haven't we?
Yeah.
And I think usually when we use the word orthogonal, we're using it in either a more everyday kind of literary usage or we're using it in a more kind of statistical or social science
mathematical
usage.
Way, yeah.
Yeah, but there are so many specific mathematic definitions of orthogonal that honestly I don't even understand. I don't think we're usually using it in those very specific ways. So, you know, the number one most common definition when you look across different dictionaries is the idea that orthogonal means lying at a right angle. It's perpendicular. So when you look at two angles and they are opposite one another, those angles are orthogonal. That's the kind of most straightforward Euclidean geometrical way to understand it. But there are vector definitions. There are like complicated vector definitions. There are matrix algebra definitions. But when it comes down to it, the basic, I think, takeaway, because the etymology of the word is very, very clear. The etymology really does come back to the early Greek and probably even Proto-Indo of this idea of ortho meaning straight and gonia or gonal meaning angle. So straight angle, which ultimately came to be known as right angled. So that really speaks to that idea of something being perpendicular or at right angles to one another. And the main thing to remember here is that those things don't intersect. And so that's really where the sense that we use quite often in social science, I use it all the time in my work, is that factors or variables are orthogonal. So let's say that we're doing a study where we're trying to figure out multiple dependent variables and how they might feed into an independent variable. And we want to test each of these independently. And we find that there's lots of crossover between the two of them. Those things would not be orthogonal and they're not good for your model. because they have dual explanatory value. So what's really important a lot of times when you're building good, at least predictive models, like you're building a regression model in psychology, sociology, biology, whatever the case may be, you want factors that are orthogonal. You don't want to test the same thing twice on two different factors. So you want things that don't cross over one another. And so that's what orthogonal factors are, like different variables that have explanatory power that don't necessarily overlap too much. We use it a lot to talk, even just like in a social setting, about things that are, or I should say in a literary setting, just things that are independent of one another.
They don't track with each other.
Yeah, they don't track with each other. That's another good way to put it. I love, though, by the way, the do you guys ever look at Urban Dictionary?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Of course, it's hilarious.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, the first definition in Urban Dictionary is great because it's like a pretty straightforward definition. But the second definition, a word used by the tech savvy to sound smarter than they really are, more specifically, a math term that means perpendicular, but not just in 2D, but in any dimension, now commonly used to indicate an idea or concept that stands apart so much from everything else that it sticks out, is from left field or is third way. And then the quote, you know, they always have a quote. I have this coworker who keeps using the word orthogonal, usually after he mentions some idea he thinks is God's gift to man. Can't wait to get this word into my vocab as soon as I figure out what it means. It's so one of those words, right, where you hear people use it all the time. And unless you actually know what it means, contextually, it could mean lots of different things. And so it is important to understand what's implied by things being orthogonal, which I think the cleanest thing you can think of is that they don't cross over one another. They don't track with one another. They're statistically or fundamentally independent in some way. Now, maybe if we get into the math, we can talk about how they're independent of one another. But I think for the most part, a good grasp of the word means that they're independent. That's a good kind of takeaway, at least at a very basic level.
Yeah, I tend to use the word in two ways. So one is when just physically two things are going in different directions, or they're, you know what I mean? They're not, you know, not parallel.
Yeah.
Or
they're perpendicular.
Or abstractly, just when some idea or some factor or something is like completely unrelated to something else.
Yeah, like a non sequitur could be orthogonal, but also so could two things that have nothing to do with one another.
Yeah.
Like if those things are orthogonal, they don't, you know, a change in this one is not going to affect a change in that one.
All right. So guys, really quick, this is a fun one that I wrote about recently. We've talked in the past about how believing is seeing, right? That's sort of a core skeptical concept that we talk about, that your internal your internal model of the world affects how you process information, how you perceive it.
For sure.
You see what you know, in a way. So there was a recent study which adds one little tiny piece to this puzzle, but it's an important piece, and I think it's good to review what we're talking about. So this is looking at the visual system itself. And prior to this study, it's always good to say, like, what did we know before the study? What did the study show? Now what do we know, right? So prior to the study, it was pretty well established that the visual system is hierarchical, meaning that there's sort of basic levels of processing that happens even in the retina, in the subcortical, you know, nuclei that the information goes through, and then it gets put together in the primary visual cortex where you get an image, right? And there's three dimensionality at that point. There is shading, there is color.
Yeah, like specialized neurons for vertical lines versus horizontal lines.
Yeah,
versus
right.
Edges.
Yeah. For contrast, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, like, it's almost like Photoshop in your brain, right? It's just doing basic. Yeah, it's like you get the raw image from your retina and then your brain turns it into a JPEG, right? Or a bitmap. It's actually closer to a bitmap.
Or a GIF.
No, it's a bitmap. If you wanted to make an analogy, it's like literally you have neurons that are pixels, you know. But in any case, and in fact, if you looked at the picture of the neurons as they are activating, it would make the picture of what you're seeing. So there's what we call somatotopic mapping. The physical mapping relates to the representative mapping. Does that make sense? Where the neurons are affects what they're representative. Anyway, it's the most obvious in the visual system because it's literally a bitmap of an image. But it's just an image at that point. Then it has to go to hierarchical levels of visual processing where you say, all right, what is it? You know, what object is that? And what does it mean? And right?
That's where like the visual form agnosia comes in, where people see things like, is it a face? Don't know what they're for. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, is it a face? What emotion does that face have? Do I know this person? How do I feel about them? You know, that all comes in at higher levels. So the question is there ever a point at which our memory is influencing our visual construction and at those higher levels?
Oh, must be.
I would say absolutely.
We've seen old studies of people watching car wrecks and then having speaking totally different versions of what they saw based on being primed right beforehand.
Yeah, so that's priming. But what about your memory of an image itself? Does that affect your construction of a new image? And again, the thinking is probably yes, but where does that happen in the brain? So now we get to the new research. The new research looked at what are called Mooney images. I don't know if we've ever used that specific term on the show. Mooney? A Mooney image. No, do you know what that is, Kara?
I know what a Mooney is, but not a Mooney image.
No. M-O-O-N-E-Y. A Mooney image is a standard paradigm where you take an image, black and white, and then you degrade it to such a point that it's very difficult to recognize what the picture is.
Okay.
Right? So you're seeing a bunch of splotches, black and white splotches. But it is based on an actual image. And so
like a Dalmatian?
Your brain kind of fills it in.
There is a pattern there, but it's an ambiguous pattern. And then – but the paradigm is this. Then you show the undegraded image to somebody. And that results in what's called disambiguation because then they're able to recognize the degraded image.
Immediately. Okay. Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. Sure. So – like on my website, there's a picture of a puppy.
Aww.
And then next to it is a bunch of splotches, but it's clearly the same picture. And of course, when you see the picture of the puppy, you have absolutely no problem recognizing that picture of the puppy in the splotchy degraded image.
Yeah. Well, right. It makes sense. Of course. Right. Especially when they're right next to each other like that.
Well, yes. So, but if you just showed somebody the splotchy image, they wouldn't necessarily know what it was. But then you show them the puppy and then like, oh, okay, that's a puppy. But then you show them the picture an hour later, a day later, a month later, a year later.
I bet you they still see the puppy.
They retain it.
They still see the puppy.
Yeah.
So the memory of the image of the puppy is affecting their interpretation of the ambiguous image. What the study showed using, I believe it was fMRI scans, was that the default mode network is involved. Now, the reason why that's important is because up to this point, the thinking was that the DMN, the default mode network, is only involved in recalling memories and internal processes, but not in external stimuli. So this is the first study to show that the default mode network is actually involved in constructing perception. So it's not just internal. It's also interacting with external information. And so what's happening is your memory of the image is then communicating back down the hierarchy, telling the more fundamental visual cortex how to process the image so that it conforms with the memory of the unambiguous image. Does that make sense? And that sort of downward hierarchical communication has also been previously shown in other studies. So this confirms that.
So Steve, maybe it would be helpful to talk about what the DMN actually is.
Yeah. So that's the default mode network it's a network in the brain that gets activated on fMRI. You know, when we're looking at what part of the brain's lighting up, it lights up when people are recalling memories. Right. But previous research showed that only that it lights up when you're recalling information that's already in your head.
When aren't you doing that though? Either even subconsciously.
Well, it's the interesting thing is that the default mode network is suppressed, or at least they think it's, you know, negatively correlated with attention. So it's like when you're actively doing something, you don't see activity in this area.
Right. When you're looking at a picture, it doesn't get, but if you're disambiguating a degraded picture, it does light up.
Interesting.
So that's the new bit. That's the new bit. Yeah. Cause you're, so the question is, And so it seems as if, in fact, you know, in this study, the memory had more of an influence on how the image was reconstructed than the image itself.
That makes sense that you would have this like really quick shortcut in your main that's in your processing that's based on schemas, right? You already have schemas of what things are in your head. You develop them as a child. Certain things in this category look this way, and I'm going to lump them all together. And that's why when we see, you know, a penguin or a flamingo for the first time, we're like, that's a bird. I'm very confused. Maybe not a flamingo. They look like birds, but a penguin or, you know, something that doesn't really look like a bird. It's like super confusing, and we have to readjust our schema.
Well, let me give you a more mundane example. So when I first started paying attention to birds, for a while, I can't remember exactly how long, but probably for weeks, I thought that black-capped chickadees and nuthatches were the same bird.
I'm Googling these things.
And until I saw them both together, I'm like, holy shit, that's two different birds. And then
nuthat? You said a nuthat?
A nuthatch.
What was the second bird? I've never...
They're doing it deliberately, Steve. They have to be naming these birds these weird names deliberately.
Yeah, birders are weird, but...
Steve, that reminds me of the girl in high school who thought you and I were the same damn person until she saw us together.
that must have been hilarious.
Yeah, it's true. But Jay, remember, because I was reminded of that because your wife Courtney said the same exact thing, that she confused those two same birds together until she figured out that they were different. But then now that you know that they're different, they look nothing alike, you know? So like in my head, it's like, oh my God, how did I ever confuse a nuthatch with a black-capped chickadee? I mean, it looks so different. But when you have limited templates in your memory of what to slot these, you know, birds into – yeah, that's it. Has the black on the head and the gray on the sides, and it looks the same.
Sort of eyeliner.
It's important.
It's interesting. So, of course, if you're out in the woods hunting for Bigfoot, when you see the blob squatch, right, the blobs, your brain fits those blotches into the thing you're looking for that you have in memory as your template for what you're looking for.
Yeah, and it's also so cool to watch little kids as they're, you know, first exploring the world and as their template matching constantly make all these really understandable mistakes that are really funny.
Yeah, and it happens with words too. I remember someone told me this, I don't know if this was Liz, Bob, or somebody else, but in their kindergarten class, the kids were all talking about being checked for headlights.
Yeah, that's so cute. And of course, Alzheimer's, famously, everybody thinks it's old-timers.
Old-timers disease, yeah. Right, so if you don't have the word in your memory banks, you'll match it to the closest one that you do have in your memory banks, and that's what you actually hear. But here's the thing, just to bring this home, that it's not what you think you hear, it's what you hear. It's not what you think you see. It's what you actually see. Because, again, your brain is communicating back down to the primary visual cortex saying, make this image look like a puppy. And it actually changes the way you construct the image.
That's how phonemes work, because languages are made up of discrete units of sound called phonemes. And if you grow up to a specific set of phonemes for a language, when you try to speak another language with different phonemes, you know, you hear a sound and your brain morphs it into a phoneme that you're familiar with. And that helps create accents and all sorts of stuff. So it's a kind of a similar thing. Your brain is just doing this work behind the scenes for you.
Yeah. What are you thinking about? Yeah.
But now we know that the default mode network is involved with this process, and so memory is explicitly involved in this construction process, which is, but it's always a good lesson. Got to remind our audience about this. It's a fundamental aspect of neuropsychological humility. Just understanding how your brain works is critical to being skeptical, you know, and you should no longer, after listening to the show, you should no longer say things like, I know what I saw, or I clearly remember. Sorry. It's not how your brain works.
Yeah. Like, you may be true, but what you remembered was not what was in reality.
Right.
What, Steve, who was it that recently we interviewed, or somebody who blurbed the book or something, who was obsessed with the phrase neuropsychological humility?
Tim Minchin.
Yes.
Yeah. He liked that term.
It is a good phrase.
Thank you. All right. Since I made it up, there's a lot of those good phrases in the book, by the way. Available now at Amazon. Yeah. All right. Jay.
Yeah.
Tell us about this tipping point that we're getting to with global warming.
Oh, not a tipping point.
dun, dun.
Not a tipping point.
I think we're already past a tipping point. That 350.
Well, that's
Michael Mann thinks so.
This is a predicted tipping point. I like to refer to this as out of the frying pan into global warming. That's what we're going to have going on now, guys. In a report that came out on Monday, August 5th, named Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. This was published by American Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The scientists who prepared the report, they warn of global temperature rise more than 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial temperatures. So if we get to that level, a series of events will take place that will turn the Earth into this hothouse Earth that they're talking about. And this means that big parts of the Earth will become uninhabitable and will have a dramatic rise in sea levels. And lots of things are going to happen automatically once we get up into that temperature range. So they're saying that these hothouse temperatures could stabilize between 4 and 5 degrees Celsius. That's 7 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Which is everything that I say in these temperatures is higher than pre-industrial levels, right? So we take a baseline like 0 degrees at pre-industrial levels. And right now, you know, we're at 1 degree above pre-industrial levels.
Okay, I see. So we're zeroing that out.
Yeah. That's the zero marker. That's before we were polluting the Earth.
Well, before we were polluting at the level we are now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was negligible.
It's pre-industrial. It's pre-industrial.
Exactly. Pre-industrial. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we still did shit to the planet pre-industrial, but it wasn't as effective.
Not on the volume that we're, nowhere near. The lead author, Will Steffen of the Australian National University, said that the problem is once global warming reaches 2 degrees Celsius, other events are likely to follow. And these are called feedbacks. And in this case, what this means is that processes will occur that will warm on their own and in a series. So even if we became carbon neutral globally, once this gets put in motion, there's nothing that we can do to stop it. And there's a series of events that will take place that are all going to be essentially be a domino effect, one hitting the other, where when A happens, then B is going to happen. When B happens, then C is going to happen. And these are predictable things that the scientists are outlining in the report. Now, I'm not talking about a 3 foot rise in sea levels here, because that's probably going to happen no matter what we do at this point. We're talking about 60 meters or 197 feet from today's sea levels. And if you haven't seen a map of what the Earth will look like, just type in, world map at 200 feet, sea rise, something like that. And you will find.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
The most frightening post-apocalyptic picture of the Earth that you could imagine. And that's what they're saying is going to happen. So this year we're seeing intense heat waves and wildfires, right? It's in the news. It's happening right now in California. They're having the worst wildfire that they probably have ever had. And many places around the globe are having these types of conditions. We've also seen some extreme weather. We had a tornado here in Connecticut. We actually had another tornado here last week in Connecticut. Did you guys know that?
Yeah, I did.
Yep.
Oh, cool. I mean, not cool, but weird. Yeah. Was it? Did anybody get hurt?
No, it was like a typical mild tornado, not like the freaky ones we had a couple months ago, but yeah.
No, but still.
Yeah, I guess it's not cool, but like, I don't know, I just love tornadoes.
Highly uncommon for this to happen twice in one summer here, Kara. Really, it's not
well,
right.
Well, and also, I mean, we've been talking about this for months. Look at the heat wave in England. Look at the heat wave here. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
This year
is
insane. The wildfire, California is literally on fire. We have the worst wildfire we've ever had in the history of the state right now.
Yeah.
It's a
coincidence?
Horrible.
Yeah.
The car fire. Yeah. Ugh, it's terrible.
It's funny. Every time I hear car fire, I think car fire.
Well, the weird thing is, Steve, did you see the new report? They know that it was caused by a blowout on the freeway and the sparks from the car tire.
So a car fire caused the car fire?
Yes.
That's funny.
I know. It will be funny after we put it out.
The really troubling part of this report says that once we pass what they call the threshold in air quotes, or the point of no return, then the Earth would experience a higher average global temperature than that has occurred in the last 1.2 million years. And once the Earth warmed up enough, lots of things, like I said, are going to start happening. And they listed some of these things like carbon sinks, forest dieback, ice retreat, and increased bacteria respiration. And that one is really bad. You might have seen the news report that came out not too long ago that said that the Earth has entered this new geological era. You guys remember this? It's called the Anthropocene.
Changed that. There's a new name for it now. The Meghalayan. Meghalayan. It's one of the three newly designated time intervals during the Holocene. We're in the Meghalayan.
So that specifically means
that the Earth is being directly changed by human activity.
Mm. Yeah.
Which has never been measured or was measurable before. And we're currently about 1 degree Celsius higher than pre-industrial temperatures, like I said. And our global average temperature is rising 0.17 degrees Celsius per decade. And you think, okay, so we've got some time here. But we really don't, because, you know, it's not like everyone just wakes up one morning 30 years from now and says, hey, we're going to start behaving correctly. It's really, it comes down to, we need like technology, and we need to make a paradigm shift culturally, globally, which is a big deal. You know, this isn't something that's going to just happen slowly over time in the next year. This is something that could take a couple of decades to fully achieve. We could really do this, and everything will get better because we'll be on an electric economy, which will be much cleaner, much more efficient. I know this is semi pie in the sky, but you know, we could have clean energy, like for real, globally, you know, and fusion might happen.
Fusion, baby, it'll happen.
I think it will happen.
But yeah, but probably not fast enough.
Probably.
But we do have other types of clean energy that we could,
we could do it. I think we should be preparing for fusion. You know, we want everything to be electric that by the time power is free or, you know, pennies on the dollar. You know what I mean? Like, this effort has to start now.
We need next generation fission. That's the only thing that's going to bridge us there in time, in my opinion.
I guess you're right. But, you know, they're getting rid of these plants, these power plants, Steve, not putting in new ones, you know?
That's true. But I also read a report that the nuclear industry is reacting and they are designing smaller, more efficient power plants that can burn more of their fuel, that are, you know, safer, more cost effective, and we'll be fine. You know, the report was saying that for the last 50 years, people have been predicting the death of the nuclear industry and they just keep adapting. So I hope that that's correct. I hope that that optimistic view of the fission industry is correct, because I don't think we're going to develop fusion in time to prevent us from getting to the 2 degree C tipping point. And I don't think we're going to get there with solar and wind, although I think that's the future. I don't think it's going to happen fast enough.
Well, that's my question. I don't know. It's hard to say whether we see it happening in smaller countries already. I feel like there are ways for that to happen, but we need the political will, which doesn't seem to be there. I think it could happen. We're just not making it happen.
That's my big point, Kara, that I wanted to end my piece on, was that this really is going to come down to the population of the Earth. Like, all of us have to get out and vote and make these things happen. You know, in the United States, it does come down to voting, but it also does come down to us educating people, you know, be the voice of reason that understands what's going on, and try to, without being too overly emotional, explain to people like just how dire this is. This is a big deal. This is something that will affect your kids.
All right. But let's, you know, put this into perspective a little bit. So everything that you're talking about is if the projections in this paper are true. And that's a big if. This is more of a hypothesis, right? They're arguing that 2 degrees Celsius is a tipping point to this domino effect, where one feedback loop raises the temperature enough to trigger another feedback loop, which raises the temperature enough to trigger another feedback loop. So there's a lot of sort of, you know, connections in this chain that they're making. And I'd like to, you know, see how this goes through the meat grinder of peer review and how the climatologists, you know, react to this paper, and whether or not, you know, there a consensus emerges about whether or not this tipping point multiple domino effect is real. If it is, what they're saying is if we get to 2, eventually we'll get to 4 or 5. There'll be nothing to stop it. And therefore we need to make we have to set our sights on 1.5. We really have to stop, you know, make sure that we don't warm beyond 1.5, beyond pre-industrial levels. 2 is not going to do it, because if we get to 2, then all this badness is going to happen.
But we should be setting our goals there anyway.
I know, but I agree. But the thing is, this is like saying, yeah, there's a chance that asteroid is going to hit the Earth. Yeah, but there's a chance it's not going to hit the Earth. Okay, you're right, but what chance are you willing to take? We need to start building our rockets now or whatever. We shouldn't wait until we're sure it's going to hit the Earth, because then it's going to be too late.
I'd also take your analogy further, because that's a single event. Like, whether or not this thing pans out, there are horrible detrimental effects of climate change left and right. So regardless of whether this specific tipping point is important, it's not one asteroid. It's like being showered by asteroids.
No, you're right. Even if this paper is completely wrong, we still need to prevent prevent, you know, the planet from warming. It just, it won't get, it means we won't get as bad as quickly.
Exactly.
But it does mean that, you know, it's going to happen eventually if we keep warming the planet. And it's certainly everything to our advantage to stop it, you know, to prevent the warming from happening. We definitely want to get to a place where we have a green, sustainable energy infrastructure that is not progressively warming the planet. We have to get there eventually. We don't know exactly how soon we need to get there to prevent really bad things from happening, but we should make, you know, pretty conservative assumptions here.
Oh, for sure. We want to be under that cutoff. And
yes,
the truth of the matter is many models have shown that even if we did a reverse course today, which is impossible, if we said today we are not going to contribute anymore to climate change and all greenhouse emissions are going to stop, there would be further downstream effects. Like,
no, they're still going to, we would still get warmer over the next 100 years.
Exactly.
Carbon dioxide has its effect over about 100 years. Methane has its effect over about 20 years. So, yeah, it's not like the warming itself would stop on a dime. There's a certain inertia to it. So, yeah, we have to be looking 100 years ahead, which means we have to be speculating. We have to make the best models that we can, and we're never going to be certain. And in any global warming scenario, we will have to act without certainty before we can be certain. That's just a fact. But, you know, I think it makes sense to listen to the consensus of scientific opinion on this. And it's kind of a win-win, you know, like going to a green, sustainable energy infrastructure is a win-win. Why not do it? There's really no reason not to do it.
Exactly.
All right, Bob, I know we've touched on this before, but tell us about this update on using novel amino acids to make proteins.
Oh, boy.
I've read about
this. Yeah, this is cool. So a team of chemists at Boston College have developed a method to have higher organisms like humans create proteins using amino acids that have never been used before. This was published recently in the journal Cell Chemical Biology. So, okay, where did we start here? So let's start simply. Proteins are the shit. They are an amazing bio macro molecule. So these are the chemicals or molecular machines that are the foundation of all of biology. There's no biology as we know it without proteins. They're critical to biological structure, function, regulation. They facilitate chemical reactions in the body. They transport molecules. They build structures and on and on and on. An endless array of functions and abilities and key things that they do. So every process, essentially every process that occurs in cells involves proteins, pretty much every damn one. Most of the other biomolecules that exist, they're lazy. They just sit there like an inert couch potato, and it's the proteins that jump on the couch and get them to do stuff. They're doing all the work. So proteins are, in turn, they're made of things too. They're made up of a string or strings of amino acids. We've all heard about amino acids. So when a gene is expressed, the DNA is essentially read off to assemble a string of amino acids. And this string then folds into itself to create the desired protein. Humans use 20 different amino acids combined in different ways to create the thousands of different proteins in the body. These are the canonical amino acids. They're called canonical. Now, pedants out there might point out that there might be another two canonical amino acids, selenocysteine and pyrrolysine. They've been newly found apparently in a few proteins. So, I'm not sure if that's entered standard, is it like now they say 22 because of these two new ones? Whatever. 20
to 22. It's 20 with an asterisk. And yeah, maybe there's two other ones.
Okay. There you go. So do you know how many natural amino acids there are?
Natural? What do you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Found in nature. Hundreds. I've heard numbers from 300
really?
To 500 amino acids. And think about it. I mean, you're just stringing them together. You can make an infinite, you know, array of different types of proteins with the same amino acids. So what if we could use non-canonical amino acids to create new proteins with new functions, right? So that I'm talking about using the other 478 natural amino acids, in eukaryotes, like people. Higher, you know, higher
but
order.
But they're not, but not now. found in people.
They are not. Yes, they are not found in people. They are not. So what if we could do that? So that's exactly what they're doing now. That's what they can do. These chemists have figured a way how to do this more efficiently than ever has been done before. So these chemists engineered a new strain of E. coli by essentially fusing in some molecular machinery from an archaeon microbe, using molecular machinery from the archaea domain of life. And which are basically like bacteria, but even older and more weird than bacteria. taking some of that molecular machinery and putting it into E. coli, they essentially created a new strain of E. coli that can do this, that can take non-canonical amino acids and create new proteins. And so you're just like basically creating, you know, what you want. You can insert them wherever you want within the protein. So that's what they're doing there. So what can we do with that? I mean, this, oh my God, it's just, the mind boggles, but there's two main things. One you might not have considered. One is to create probes, because as much as we know about proteins right now and the human body and the proteins and how, you know, and the genetic code behind it and how they're created, there's so much we don't know. To learn more about it, though, is very difficult, because if you try to create a probe or something that can go in there and incorporate itself and tell you what's going on, it can hurt the protein and it doesn't work. So it's very difficult. So using these non-canonical amino acids to create these special probes within known proteins, you can then find out lots of different things and learn a lot of things about their behavior and how they're created, much more than we can do now. So as a tool for learning what the proteins do and can do and how they do it, this could be an amazing, unprecedented tool. So that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is the new functionality. I mean, you're throwing in some new amino acids. You're creating new proteins. Who knows what kind of stuff we're going to be able to do with this? So, final quote, Assistant Professor of Chemistry Abhishek Chatterjee, what an awesome name, who led the project, said, you could create a protein with non-canonical amino acid in any chosen site, load it with probes that are very tiny and give out an optical signal that tells you where it's going. It could allow you to manipulate how the protein is working. You could introduce limits, so whatever the protein is doing, it can't do anymore. And you could remove the probe by using an external signal such as light. This technology opens up numerous new ways one can start to probe and engineer protein function, which would be very challenging otherwise. So there you go. So a new tool at our disposal for creating proteins that can help us learn at an unprecedented rate what's going on with proteins and more about proteins that we don't know, and for creating new novel proteins. Amazing. Really mind-boggling. I really hope there's really something to this. A couple things that I don't understand. Steve, Kara, Jay, Evan, maybe you can help me out here. If you're taking a string of amino acids and you're throwing in some new amino acids, doesn't that mean that when it folds in on itself, it's going to fold in a completely unpredictable new way?
It depends.
That would turn it into a new protein, a new completely different protein?
I mean, I don't know if that means it always will, but it could.
It depends, because not some amino acids fold the same way as other amino acids.
Oh, like if you just substitute an amino acid.
Yeah, if you substitute one amino acid for another amino acid, it may make no change in the three-dimensional structure of the protein. Huh. So the answer is it depends.
And that's really what I think we use these computational chemistry programs for, right? Yeah. Like there are really sophisticated software techniques. I don't know. I could be wrong, but they use this a lot in like pharmacology. I don't know if they're coded for new amino acids. That's probably going to be many a dissertation project. But you can actually put them in and kind of see how they would fold on themselves theoretically before
they've
you
made,
actually
yes. get they, computers they've to made, do it. I talked about this about a year, year and a half ago. They've made some amazing breakthroughs in
super
protein.
Cool.
Protein folding prediction. Yeah. Amazing. So maybe that's helping in this as well. But this, can you imagine? I mean, we've got hundreds and hundreds of amino acids that we could use to create novel proteins. Who knows what kind of freaky cool humans we could make?
True. But I'd also be so scared of like other types of prion diseases. Things where the protein folding goes amok and is not a positive outcome. Definitely something we'd want to watch for.
Yeah, I won't be a guinea pig, but
some monsterism.
It just turns you into goo eventually, but that's
it's worth
Enjoy the ride.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
Guys, KiwiCo creates these really cool hands-on projects for kids that make learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math fun. And what you could do is you could get these and you could do these experiments or these projects with your child and teach them about science. And the really important thing is that they're a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, their mission is to provide the next generation of innovators with the tools and foundation they need to become creative problem solvers, critical thinkers, kind of the same as our mission. But the cool thing is there are different types of projects for kids of different ages. So whether you have a 2 or 3 year old or you have a 14 or 15 year old, they're kits that are tailored just for them, for their interests, and for their kind of skill level. Evan, you got one recently, didn't you?
Oh, I got not just one. I have 3 of them here that arrived today. The Glow Lab, the Fire Lab, and the Vortex Lab.
Ooh, Fire Lab. I want to play with that one.
The Fire Lab allows you to ignite chemicals and see all the different colors of combustion. And it comes with 7 experiments in just this one kit.
Cool.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is really cool.
Yeah, so KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects for kids, visit kiwico.com/skeptics. That's KIWICO.com/skeptics to try KiwiCo for free. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Evan, tell us about this bizarre rogue planet. I love rogue planets.
Bizarre rogue planet, indeed. So when I think of planets and I think of gas giants and these sorts of things, Jupiter jumps into my mind. I think it jumps into most people's mind. I admit having a Jupiter bias when it comes to giant planets.
And you're Jovian file?
Jovian bias, can I call it that? I think we have a chapter in the book about Jovian bias, maybe.
It's false advertising, Evan.
With this news item and my Jovian bias firmly in place, I read that back in 2016, astronomers discovered a rogue object, maybe a planet. The object has a simple...
Maybe a failed star.
Exactly. Mm. It could be a brown dwarf. It could be a brown dwarf or something like that. The object has a simple 21-character designation. SIMP J01365663+0933473. We will just call it SIMP for short.
Mm-hmm.
SIMP. And this is the object that we're talking about in this news item. Here are some facts about SIMP. SIMP is rogue, as we mentioned, right? Which means it's not orbiting another large object. It is free, free as the solar wind blows. SIMP lives about 20 light years from Earth. SIMP is about 200 million years old. That's very young. That is a baby, cosmologically speaking, definitely. SIMP has a surface temperature of about 825 degrees Celsius. SIMP also has a magnetic field, right? No big deal. Jupiter has a magnetic field too, but wait a minute. This magnetic field is 200 times stronger than Jupiter's.
Whoa.
Yes, exactly.
So makes it about 4,000 times stronger than the Earth's.
So that is what has the astronomers very excited about this planet, one of the things. That's according to the study's lead author, Melody Cao, an astrophysicist at Arizona State University. And she says that this particular object is exciting because studying its magnetic dynamo mechanisms can give us new insights on how the same type of mechanisms can operate in extrasolar planets. So rogue planets, extrasolar planets, anything, we're learning more about them. Now, SIMP also generates auroras. Now, that's a head scratcher because when we think about auroras in our solar system, we think about solar wind, which is what contributes greatly to the effect of the auroras that happen on Earth and the other planets in our system.
It creates them. It doesn't just contribute. It actually is responsible for the entire phenomenon.
It doesn't have anything to do with magnetism?
Well, you have to have a magnetic field in order to it. But
the solar wind is funneled by the magnetosphere into the poles to the
So it's both of those things together.
You have to have them both, right? As far as we know,
solar particles.
But apparently not anymore because you've got this rogue planet now, this giant rogue planet, which seemingly are not under the effects of any solar winds anywhere. So why are there
really
auroras?
Wait? Just because it's not in orbit, it's not close enough to a star.
Right.
That's correct.
Like,
it's not near any star.
Things, Oh, okay. So that's just another feature that it's not near any star.
It's a rogue.
It's rogue. It is on
I get that, but couldn't something not be in orbit and still be... No, I guess not, because it'd be outside of its whatever heliopause or whatever you want to call it. Okay.
Well, that doesn't have to be outside the heliopause, but that's pretty damn far away.
But if it were within it, wouldn't it have gone into orbit?
Oh, not, it depends. Not necessarily.
So maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's close enough that it's being affected by some sort of...
Clearly, the magnetic field is interacting with particles from the planet itself, causing the aurora, not from the particles from that's the solar wind.
Oh, okay.
So this is new to astronomers, and they're studying.
That's awesome.
Closely, which is very, very
that's
cool.
Cool.
It is very cool.
Wow. So where do the auroras take place? Then it wouldn't be at the magnetic poles. Then it would be, could be right. Would it be?
Well, it could still be at the magnetic poles. Why wouldn't it be?
Could be, but doesn't have to be.
It still would be drawing them along the magnetic field lines, right?
But because because that's coming from within the planet.
Yeah, it's coming from the planet itself.
Right.
It could be happening at the equator even.
Why must it be a polar phenomenon?
Yeah, that's what's drawing it, but it could be drawing it all the way across the surface of the planet, right?
Yeah, but it's concentrating it at the poles, and that's where it lights up. Anyway.
Yep, another fact. Well, it's very cool. And then the last... big thing about this particular article is that they used radio telescopes to be able to detect radio signals being generated by the aurora. And so now, guess what? Here we go. Potentially a new way to find exoplanets.
Cool.
We look for the radio signals coming off of aurora on the planets, whether they're rogue or not. And there you go. We may have a new mechanism here. They're going to look much, much closer into this, and more study is, of course, required.
Yeah, but this is a big planet with a massive magnetic field.
Yeah.
So we don't know how common that is. I think the big thing here is what's causing the magnetic field 200 times stronger than Jupiter's? What mechanism? What's the dynamo that's doing it? So that's what the astronomers are going to have to try to figure out. And that'll probably teach us something new about planetary mechanics.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
Very cool stuff.
And there could be moons around this planet, right? Around this
exo moon.
Probably
an exo rogue moons. I love it.
And there could be life on those moons. Who knows?
You guys think we'll ever be able to move a moon into position so it's in orbit around something in our solar system?
An asteroid.
What do you mean by ever?
Just for context, something as big as our moon.
Oh, move a moon, not make a moon.
Yeah, move a moon. Yeah.
Not with any extrapolation of current technology.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's why I ask these kinds of questions.
Probably a level two society on the Kardashev scale.
You guys remember that horrible TV show about the moon falling out of orbit? And
I do not.
Affected gravity, and it was fiction.
They got everything wrong.
They got everything wrong.
It was almost like they said, how can we piss off anybody that knows about science?
Should we get a science advisor? No, we'll make it up as we go along.
Yeah, basically.
What did the moon do?
A piece of a neutron star flung by the Earth and knocked the moon out of its orbit, and it was swinging around really close to the Earth. And
why was it a neutron star?
I don't know.
Wait, this is a whole thing.
Wow. That was, there was a piece, a tiny piece of a neutron star. It's like, you know what? It wouldn't be a neutron star anymore if it was a small piece like that.
Right.
You need the full mass in order to get that. Oh, it was crazy.
And also, can a neutron star really break apart like that?
No.
No, the force is too strong there.
It would explode
it would take a lot of energy to do that. You have neutron stars colliding into each other, and they just collapse into a bigger neutron star or a black hole. They don't have chunks flying off.
I mean, the writers of that show should be punished, right? Somebody should spank them, right?
There's so many things like that where there's
Right now?
Uh-huh. That was a good no. Sorry, I almost didn't catch your transition.
But spanking is not a good idea?
They should not be spanked.
Well, tell us why.
Let's talk about that. So there's a blog post on Psychology Today written by a psychologist named Bernard Golden. I think he talks a lot about anger. That's his specialty. And this blog post covers a lot of recent research having to do with spanking, slapping, corporal punishment, physical punishment, discipline, whatever you want to call it. So the question here, and I think it's maybe not an age-old question, but quite a modern question is it okay to spank your kids? Is you know, a little slap here and there something that should be avoided? Is it something that's, you know, kind of like up to the parent to decide? At what point does this become a legal matter? These are complicated questions. And this article argues very strongly with some good supporting evidence that this is not something we should do. We should not be physically punishing for discipline. But I was blown away, and we'll talk a little bit about the research, but I was blown away when I shared this article, because I, you know, my social media channels, my Facebook, my Twitter, I share science stories all the time. That's what I do. I curate science stories and I share them so that I can stay abreast of what's going on in the news. And when I shared this, I was blown away by the types of responses that I got. I mean, I got some really good ones, but goodness, like, how about Facebook seemed to be the worst of it, a little worse than Twitter. Physical pain is the ultimate teacher. And then this person arguing vehemently about having these rights taken away. Another person here, yay, liberal science. If you don't have fear of the consequences, then you realize you can do what you like. You could ground me, ban TV, etc. That was all laughable and never a deterrent. There's nobody in a lab going to tell me not to do something I know worked for me. I grew up with respect and manners and knowing right from wrong. I also grew up knowing if I acted the bollocks, the punishment would make sure I didn't think about doing it again. But of course, one of my favorite comments in this feed was, yay, anecdotes. I also, and, you know, here's a really good one that, like, I think supports a lot of the things that were in the article, which we'll get to. If your child is too young to reason with, then they won't understand why you're hitting them. If they're old enough to reason with, then reason with them.
Ooh, I like that.
Really where a lot of this comes down to. Also, another argument here, in no other situation would striking someone be a reasonable resolution to poor behavior. I can't hit my employees or my boss when they're misbehaving. I can't strike my spouse or my significant other. I can't slap my neighbor when they're noisy. I can't punch my political representatives when they're malfeasant or philandering. Children are considerably more fragile and vulnerable than any of the people I named. Why should I be able to hit my kids if it's not an option any other time? And here's the thing. Whether or not these legal ramifications should stand or not, let's talk a little bit about what the actual literature show. And most of what's supported in this argument is a recent it's not really a meta-analysis. I mean, it is in some ways a meta-analysis, but what these researchers did, it was just recently published in American Psychology, is that they looked at a lot of evidence that's been published over decades. They looked at a lot of studies on the connection between physical punishment of children and outcomes, the outcomes on these kids' lives. And they realized that because this is not, these aren't double-blind studies, they, like, it would not be ethical to take some kids and beat them and take others and not beat them, that these are more like environmental studies. So we're looking at this stuff after the fact and drawing correlations. But they said, how strong are these correlations? And at what point can we start to say that there may be a causal factor here? And what they found is that, you know, by and large, kids who are physically punished have negative outcomes later in life. And those outcomes have to do with
defending corporal punishment.
Well, there is that. It is interesting that most of the people in on both my social media channels, but even within this article, they do say that about 80% of American parents, actually more than 80% of American parents, say that they spank or slap or use physical force.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Huh. And that most of them argue that it's because it was used on them and it worked for them. And so there is sort of anecdotal reinforcement that we see a lot. Very often, people who advocate for this say it's because they experienced it. The construct that's often used is this idea of adverse childhood experiences, often called ACE. You'll see it in the literature if you start to read a lot about abuse or violence. Adverse childhood experiences are things like sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, watching your father beat your mother, dealing with incarceration of your parents, watching your parents doing drugs in front of you, severe mental illness within the family, observing suicide attempts, things like that. These are adverse childhood experiences. And a lot of this research has been done to try and figure out if this should be added to the list of adverse childhood experiences, because that's a big shift in the way we view corporal punishment, right? It's so kind of well accepted within American society. So many parents do it that putting it on a list of adverse childhood experiences is kind of a paradigm shift. And a lot of this research says that the physical punishment has met the requirement, or at least these researchers, Gershoff, the 2018 study, says that this research has met the requirements for causal conclusions, that research on spanking and physical punishment links to detrimental outcomes in children. Spanking and physical punishment contribute to the same harms as physical abuse. Spanking and physical punishment are disavowed by a number of professional organizations outside of psychology, including human rights organizations, and that their recommendations are that within the psychological ethical kind of code, that psychologists should disavow this and should teach, when they're doing psychoeducation with their clients, should teach their clients not to rely on this, and should actually call this child abuse, because when we call it assault or child abuse, it starts to carry more meaning. So it's strong, these recommendations that they're making. We'll see if the American Psychological Association takes these in and actually lays them out in new ethical guidelines or ethics codes, because those are fundamental to like maintaining your licensure. But it is interesting that it looks like, based on the evidence, these researchers, at least, and there are so – I pulled up so many related articles that show negative outcomes to spanking. Longitudinal links between spanking and externalizing behaviors, links between spanking and adult mental health impairment, making the case for it as an adverse childhood experience. New meta-analyses. This was a 2016 article looking at 160,927 and looking just at the effect sizes of these links and showing that 13 out of the 17 mean effect sizes were significant between spanking and detrimental child outcomes. So we're seeing that it looks like the evidence is relatively strong. There's a lot of evidence at this point, and it's maybe time that we take this evidence and we come up with some standards for utilizing it. So, I mean, I don't think any of us disagree with this, but it is incredible to me how entrenched the idea that, like, if my kid's being bad and I slap him, that's going to help him stop being bad, and you can't tell me what to do with how I raise my children. This is a very common mentality. It's a function, or at least this is what many psychologists who work with parents who are known to do this, they talk about it in the article. It's a function of the parent being overwhelmed and not having the skills that they need
in that moment. I agree. Yeah, they're angry and they're frustrated.
They're overwhelmed. And so this is a snap thing that they do because their tendency might be more violent or because they don't know what else to do. And so in this case, I think a lot of psychoeducation and a lot of training could be really helpful to sort of, you know, we could see this shift within a generation or two.
Timeouts, baby. I think it's perfectly well.
Totally. So interesting to see the feedback on my social media channels. Hard to stay silent there, but, you know, always interesting to see the debates that come up because it gives you a little microcosm of what some of the pushback is going to be if and when we do start to see regulation
Parenting is one of those things that, like, everyone thinks they're good at.
Exactly.
And they have a right to do whatever they want to do.
There's a lot of confirmation bias here. But what we're seeing is that these individual anecdotes aren't really holding water. That the truth of the matter is people who are punished by their parents, corporally punished, do tend to have negative outcomes.
Yeah. Well, I think the science has to come first.
Absolutely.
I do think that that's what will make the sea change is – If it's been studied enough where we could say, yeah, here we have some objective evidence that this is not effective. It's not a good way to go.
Yeah. Not only is it not effective, but it could actually be causing lasting harm. And that's exactly. Is it worth it to you?
Right.
To do that to your kid. Yeah, for sure.
All right, Jay, who's that noisy?
Okay. Last week I played this noisy.
Take me to your leader.
Planet. So, anybody?
Sounds like an aquatically adapted mammal. I'm just guessing.
Such a dick. That's why you got to stop telling us what they are.
Yeah, that was cheaty. All right, the worst guess I got came in from Damian H., and he said, hello, all. This week's sound is of a person being digested and sucked into a computer.
Oh, like in Tron?
I like it.
Yeah.
Funny.
But 1982 Tron.
I got a couple more guesses here. Henry Thomas said this week's noisy is a piece of hot metal being quenched in a liquid, probably water. Nobody won.
Nobody
guessed it. This one is awesome, though. This one is really, really cool. I believe I played the underwater version of this noisy last year. So the answer is this. It is a... What is it, guys? It's a seal. It's doing the noise that it makes underwater, outside of the water.
Do it again.
Right?
That's insane. Where do you think they put the microphone? Is it far away from him or is it like right up against his
No, it's not throat? That close. I mean, they're probably at least 5 to 10 feet away.
That is crazy. I'm not changing my seal impression, though.
Yeah.
It's easier to arf arf.
Is that slowed down, Jay?
I don't think so. I think it was a real time. I mean, we had a video with it, so it would look real time to me. Very cool. I mean, now that you know what it is and you hear it again, you can kind of hear... Like, yes, that's what it, that's that noise, that underwater
but
noise.
But it's still blowing my mind.
It is. Yeah. It's weird that an animal is making that noise.
Yep. Totally. I think it's an alien.
That's evolution right there. All right. So here is this week's noisy. Yep.
It's a piggy.
A frog.
So if you think you know what this is, and please, if you heard a cool noisy this week. Now, you know, I'm very particular about the noisies I pick. A lot of people send stuff in. I can't use it for my own reasons. But I think, you know, there's a quality control thing. So if I don't pick your noisy, it doesn't mean that I don't appreciate it. It just means that, Steve won't
just means
me
it sucks.
Yeah, it just wasn't good enough. No, but there's lots of things. There's markers there that I need. You know, first of all, it has to have some type of interesting thing, right? Did I say that the way you like or not like, Kara?
Oh, I like it. I say interesting, too.
Oh, interesting.
I like interesting.
I like when someone goes, interesting.
Interesting.
Like Dracula. But send me those goddamn noisies. Please, I need them.
Why so angry?
I don't know. WTN at theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. One quick email. This one comes from Carl Fink. Carl's a friend of the show. Hey, Carl.
Carl.
And he writes, in the last show, Kara declaimed that chimpanzees are not monkeys. They're apes. Apes are monkeys. It is not possible to create a coherent clade monkey taxonomically. That does not include the apes because we apes are more closely related to, say, a baboon, old world monkey, than we are to a howler, new world monkey. You can't make a group that includes the howler and the baboon, but not us, just saying. So I think Carl is correct, but not correct.
If you're talking about,
you know where I'm going with this, Kara.
Yes,
so the problem is you can't use the word monkey and then apply cladistic rules to it because it's not a cladistic name. You know what I mean? In my opinion, I don't think that makes sense. So it is true that apes and old world monkeys make one group. That is the Katarini, Katarrhini. And that apes and old world monkeys and new world monkeys are in a group, the Simiformes, we're simians, right? So you could say
larger
we're not all monkeys. We are all simians. Mm-hmm. And then simians there's a split between the New World monkeys and the Katarini, and then the Katarini divide up into the Old World monkeys and the apes. But monkeys are a common name for New World monkeys and Old World monkeys.
Apes are not
monkeys, right?
Yeah, the common name, their features, right? The identifications usually are like, apes don't have tails. Like, there's like a handful of weird, morphological features that people use. But we know what the great apes are, and they're not monkeys. There's six of them.
Right.
And they're not monkeys.
I know. I think the confusion comes from this combination of technical and common names for groups of animals. And also, it's the Linnaean versus the cladistic schemes, right? So the Linnaean scheme of dividing up of life was not strictly evolutionary. It was based on morphology mainly.
Yeah, because it was before we knew anything about genetics.
Yeah, and there's a certain sense to it. And I've even heard, I mean, Stephen Jay Gould made a defense of using the Linnaean system over cladistics because, like, he using the example of birds, right? In the cladistic nomenclature, birds are dinosaurs. They are one tiny branch of the dinosaurian group, which is a subgroup of reptiles. Yeah. But in the Linnaean system, because birds are so much different, they deserve their own group name. You know, they're separate. I agree. However, I will say I do think that it is good to have a cladistic, meaning purely evolutionary branching order scheme of defining life. That makes perfect sense. But common names are not always going to hew to that cladistic system. And monkeys are an example of that. And also, I think like the common name dinosaur, nobody's talking about birds, you know, when you say dinosaurs. But, you know, then, of course, the pedants will say, you mean non-avian dinosaurs. Yes, I mean effing non-avian dinosaurs. And it should have been obvious from the context of my statement.
It's like when we say animals and people, pedantic people are like, you mean non-human animals.
Yeah.
Yes, we know we're animals, too. We're not trying to say that we're not.
But, you know, whatever. I mean, we are pedantic when it comes to science communication. So I get it. It's fine. But, you know, in this case, I think, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either you're talking about cladistics or you're using cladistic names, or you're using common names, which don't necessarily follow the cladistic groups. But it is, I do think that the interesting bit here is that it's interesting that old world monkeys are more closely related to apes than they are to new world monkeys. And I do think a lot of people don't know that. They think monkeys are a group.
Is cool.
It is true that monkeys are not a cladistic group. That's good to know.
And I also think that like calling an ape a monkey has more implications than just these scientific implications, right? Like sometimes these common names are meaningful for policy. They're meaningful for, I think, a broader understanding. And so there's a reason that I do think that a lot of primate researchers make sure that these distinctions are often made because great apes are threatened. I mean, not that many monkeys aren't, but these are like keystone species oftentimes, and the laws around research are very different with monkeys and apes. And so I think that there's a reason that there are distinctions that are often made.
All right. But thanks for writing, Carl. It was a good discussion. All right, guys, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Sean Carroll. Sean, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be back.
So, Sean, you are my debate partner, and I want to remind everybody that we are 1-0, baby.
Undefeated.
Undefeated. Absolutely.
I remember that debate. Yeah.
Wait. Who did you debate?
We debated Eben Alexander and the author of Life After Life. I forget his name. In a debate about life after death. And this was for the Intelligence Squared debates.
Rick Moody, I think.
Yep, you are correct. Yeah, Rick Moody. That was a lot of fun.
When was that, Steve? Was that 2 years ago?
That was a few years ago.
Four years ago, I think.
Oh, Eben Alexander's the guy who did the All the Time magazine cover. He wrote the book about
Evidence of Heaven or something.
Yeah. Yep. Proof of something.
Proof of Heaven,
proof of
life.
Proof of Heaven.
His books sell better than ours, but we won the debate.
I think we wiped the floor with them, to be honest with you. Structured debates are work well. Unstructured debates don't, because you get overwhelmed with the gish gallop. But if you have any kind of structure to it, and where there's any kind of ways of holding people accountable for the nonsense that they spew, you know, and you have to know not only your side of the debate, you have to know the other side of the debate too. I think you can do reasonably well.
But the great thing about Intelligence Squared is that they take a vote before and after. So there's an objective criterion by which you can say we won the debate.
Right.
We changed more minds than they did.
And you did.
Now, Sean, we should tell our audience. I mean, you're pretty well known, but we just, you know, should, you know, as a formality, you are an astrophysicist, correct?
I'm a physicist, not very much astro, but yeah. I'm a physicist, a theoretical physicist at Caltech, and I write books and I appear on the internet.
Right. And
I like that. That's a good bio.
Yeah. Part of the reason why you're joining us today is because you just launched a new podcast, Sean Carroll's Mindscape. I've been listening to it. It's very good. I'm enjoying it.
Well, thank you. That's great. Yeah, it's been a wonderful experience. You know, I've been on many podcasts, including this one, and of course, had thought for a long time about whether or not it would be fun to do, but it sounded like work, and it is work a little bit. But, you know, ultimately what pushed me over the edge was the idea that I would get to talk to people who are not just scientists. Like, I can talk to physicists all the time and I can talk about physics all the time. And I love doing that. But I also love talking about other people, other things to other people. And now I have a license to do it. I carry a little card that say, oh, yes, you're a world famous person about this, but I have a podcast. Please let me talk to you for an hour. And that's a great thing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's been one of the fun things about doing this show is we get to talk to people like you or other scientists or just interesting people. And they're willing to talk to us because we're recording it and publishing it on the internet.
Also, Sean, I don't know if you remember, but my other podcast, Talk Nerdy, you were episode 4. So really early on in the process. I just looked, March 24th, 2014. And even back then, you were saying, it'd be cool to do a podcast.
I didn't say I was fast. I just said, you know, I was deliberate about it. But yeah, I've been on Kara's podcast. I've been on some big ones. Joe Rogan, I was on again last week. And you know, it's fun. And I guess the other thing was I wasn't really a podcast listener myself back in the day, even though I appeared on other people's podcasts. So increasingly I started listening. And apparently the kids today, they listen to podcasts. So it's another way to reach a completely different audience than I had before.
Mm-hmm. You said, that's easy. I can do that.
And Sean, I mean, you've done, you know, TV experiences. That's a weird way to put it. You've been on TV plenty of times. You've done kind of the traditional media stuff where you're expected to speak in like pithy sound bites. But isn't it great when you do long form podcasting how you can just get deep into the nuance?
Oh, it's fantastic. And I was a little worried when I very first started out that it might be hard to fill an hour. That's not the problem.
That's not
a little bit.
We had that concern the first time we did a 24-hour show.
Yeah,
and it's remarkably easy to fill time.
It's hard to stay awake, though.
It's hard to stay awake, but yeah,
that's the challenge.
Sure. Yeah,
So yeah, I've had a wonderful collection of guests, and I have even more wonderful guests coming up. And it was more work than I expected to set it up, to, you know, buy the gear and get the account and the web page and et cetera. But actually doing it has been remarkably trouble free, even though I am the producer, et cetera. I sort of splurged on good audio equipment, et cetera, and so I can get pretty good sound quality without spending hours tweaking every little sound file, which is exactly what I wanted.
So I listened in particular to the episode with Liv Bury on probability, because it's a lot going on there that we've talked about as well. Like it's interesting, the whole poker angle, you know, thinking probabilistically and how that applies to poker. But
yeah,
but
for those who don't know, Liv Bury was one of my guests on episode 6 or something
six,
like that.
Six.
Yeah. So number one, she was someone I'd never met before. We had actually followed each other on Twitter, but never met in person. And she's a professional poker player who was a physics undergraduate. But then after winning, you know, the European poker tour, she said, yeah, this is a better way to go maybe than the looking for a physics job. So she's won over $3 million on the poker tour so far, but she's maintained this interest in science and she wants to get more into science communication. So that was a wonderful opportunity for us to talk about not just poker, but the nature of probability, how it helps you live your life.
I was particularly interested in your discussion of the Drake equation and the probability of alien civilizations, because we responded to the same article, you know, that you were talking about. We chatted about it on our show. So you seem, I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, and people have emailed us, oh, Sean Carroll disagrees with you guys. It's like, well, we'll ask him about it when he's on our show. That, so the probability of there being any other, you know, technological civilization out there capable of communicating with us is a coin flip. In the observable universe, do you buy that? Do you think that you feel comfortable with that probability?
Okay, there's a short answer and a long answer, right? The long answer gets into the question of what you mean by probability and things like that. But roughly speaking, the short answer is yeah, I kind of do buy that. Of course, it's a posterior probability, knowing that we haven't talked to them yet. So the analysis says that given the data point, that we haven't already noticed them, there's a roughly 50-50 chance that it's just because they aren't there anywhere.
But to me, that sounds like a completely made-up statistic because there are so many assumptions in there that you could basically make it any number you want, you know, based upon your assumptions. I don't doubt the math, but I mean, what are you calculating?
Sure. There's a long tradition in Drake equation thoughts of making up whatever numbers you want. Yeah, right. And I think that they it was yet another try, right? But I think that the difference was that, I mean, there are two differences. One is the one that I already mentioned, the fact that they use the data. They don't just try to do an a priori calculation of how many civilizations there should be. And number two, they took into account in a little bit better way the error bars on each one of the numbers or the different distributions, right? So when you say something like, what is the possibility that chemistry will lead to monocellular life? You can do your best at guessing what the probability is, but you should also give your lower bound and your upper bound. And so at least the methodology seemed reasonable to me, and the answer also seemed reasonable, but I don't in any way claim to be an expert on the actual calculation.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that they probably did a better job of doing the math, right? Because they used a probability distribution instead of just an average probability or whatever, which is great. Fine. Good point. But, well, it's still, again, I don't disagree with the math or the statistics. It's that coming to a conclusion that, yeah, it's 50-50 that we're the only civilization in the observable universe. What's the probability distribution on that? I bet you it's orders of magnitude, right? So at the end, I don't think you could come down to like one number like that because we don't even know if civilizations would want to communicate with us. There's so many assumptions that I think I usually have a problem with Drake equation estimates. And that is what is considered the range of possible alien civilizations is way too anthropomorphic and narrow. I think there's the possible different types of intelligent civilizations out there is far greater than our current imagination. We're constrained in ways that we can't even conceive of yet. And so when we come up with these numbers, we're thinking like people rather than the distribution of possible alien civilizations that could be out there.
Well, I certainly think that is a possible pitfall to fall into. And I think that you're right that people often do. I would disagree in two ways. These are very mild disagreements, right, compared to big disagreements we could have. But I do think that at the end of the day, if you're a good Bayesian thinking about the world, it's your job to come up with a probability. Like a 50-50 probability is basically saying, I have no idea, right? I can't really say that it's likely or unlikely. It's sort of the safest, most honest thing to say exactly in conditions of maximal uncertainty. So I think that it is a fair thing to do. The other thing, the traditional Fermi paradox argument, the Fermi paradox being that our galaxy is small compared to the number of years it's been around. So if there were civilizations that came up every so often, we should be a relatively young one and the older ones should have filled the galaxy already, is that it only needs one, right? If one out of a million civilizations do that, but there's millions of them, then we would have noticed it by now. So to use the out that, maybe civilizations don't want to talk to us, that's 100% possible, but you really need to make the argument that even if there are many civilizations, none of them have wanted to talk to us. I think it's possible, but, it's just, I think it's safe to say at the end of the day that it's close to a coin flip.
Yeah, well, talking to us is the thing there. We've only surveyed a tiny, tiny fraction of the potential sky and frequencies, et cetera. So we have very little data when it comes to that. You should interview Seth Shostak about that.
Well, so just to be a little bit more specific about this, I strongly feel that listening for alien civilizations using radio waves or other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum is a complete waste of time. We'll never find them that way. That would never be a good way for other civilizations to talk to us. It's extraordinarily wasteful to beam randomly energy out into the universe with these signals. It would be much, much more effective to go visit or to send probes or to send robots or something like that. So the real question is, why isn't the solar system crawling with robots from alien civilizations? Yeah.
Well, it's possible that because, you know, there's been life on Earth for the past few billion years, that they just don't like to mess with worlds that have life on it. We've already figured that out. I mean, we'd be very careful about contaminating Mars with our own microbes, for example. And, you know, Carl Sagan brought up the point, like, if there's even a microbe on Mars, we should just leave Mars alone. It belongs to the Martians. It's possible. Again, it's hard. You have no data points on this, obviously, but it may be the galactic rule, you know, don't mess with planets that have life on it.
Sean, do you have an opinion about whether or not you think we should interact with aliens?
I'm definitely of the opinion that I would rather not for the short term, since we are by construction way technologically behind any alien civilization we could encounter, and the track record of civilizations with massively different levels of technological achievement encountering each other is bad. And even if there's only a 0.01% chance that they come along and destroy us, I would not want to take that risk, right?
Would want to roll those dice, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to roll those dice. That's not a probability calculation I want to be involved with at a deep personal level. So I would rather human beings figure out their own stuff before we go knocking on doors of aliens.
Yeah, I think that's a very rational way to look at it.
But what happens if they come knocking on our door?
I think Bill Pullman is still around, right? He can help us out. There's ways. It depends on what they say when they knock, right? Like, I like to be optimistic, and I am optimistic. I think it's very unlikely they would come by and just wipe us out. You know, we don't have that much to offer, really. We're not even worth wiping out in some sense. But I don't know that. So I would rather not sort of make too much effort to make ourselves noticeable.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of too late, you know, because we've been broadcasting.
Yeah, oh, yeah. We're out there.
I'll tell you, though, the one thing I don't think any alien species is ever going to do is like park 20 of their ships over like the 20 most important buildings in the planet.
The Taj Mahal, the Capitol building. They always get wiped out.
Just park somewhere and they don't communicate. It's like, I think we have to come up with like, what would be an appropriate approach to encountering an alien species? Like, do you go inside their solar system and like flash a light? You know, I don't know. I'm just saying.
What you do is you mutilate their cows and you anal probe their
their life.
I think that we should just take a note from Arrival and we should listen to the ladies on this one. Right. Not to the Joint Chiefs. That's my advice.
Set up your own bowling pin. So what do you do?
Send Carol.
Well, I think you get together an international consortium of, you know, people who do this for a living, diplomats, people who, you know, understand negotiation skills and they understand multicultural viewpoints, and you at least you use the best human example we have of trying to understand other cultures when we go out to try and understand an alien culture, which may not be possible, but at least we should go out in a non-aggressive, empathic way instead of with guns blazing.
And it will be robots doing it. It's no chance of people ever getting to that point. So robot can contact is the way it's going to happen.
Our robots will talk to their robots.
We'll have their people call our people. Yeah. Work it out.
But let me just also, just to not let this slip by, I think that there is a huge chance that along the way from chemistry to us, there is some process, the likelihood of which is 10 to the minus 100. Right. Yeah. Whether it's the first cell or the first multicellular life or the first consciousness or whatever, like I could very easily imagine that we are alone in the universe. That is, I completely put no credence in all the arguments that just say, well, there are a lot of places out there. There must be life elsewhere. The chances of life on any one place could be really, really small.
as much as that could totally be true, how do you feel about that prospect? Like, does that make you really sad when you think about the fact that we could be alone?
Yeah, I think it cuts both ways. It's like learning that God doesn't exist, right? It's makes you sad that you're all alone, and it also is exhilarating that it gives you a bit of a responsibility to do things yourself, right?
The universe is ours, baby.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's ours to screw it up, at least for the next quadrillion years while the stars are bad.
Well, Sean, thanks for coming on the show. It's always great to talk with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Sean.
Looking forward to our next debate.
All right.
Whenever that's going to be.
Put our undefeated record on the line. I like it.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
You know, we like to learn because it gives us a different perspective on our reality, on all different facets of our life. And that's why we listen to The Great Courses Plus, and so should you. And we have a special thing going on this week. What is it, Steve?
A special thing.
Yeah, so this week we are listening to Sean Carroll's Dark Matter, Dark Energy, The Dark Side of the Universe. And you may recognize Sean Carroll from this episode of the show when we interview him. As you know, if you're listening to the show, he's a great speaker and his course is excellent. He goes over everything to do with dark energy and dark matter. You know, what most of the universe is made of.
That's
that
so weird.
We don't know what it is. Yeah, it's fascinating. This is like one of the epic sagas, science sagas of our time. Can't wait to see how it turns out.
I know.
Guys, this is the perfect course to get started with, or you can check out any of their other fantastic lectures. We've got a special offer where you get a free trial with unlimited access to watch and listen to the entire library at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. So sign up for
free trial
now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items for facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me to sniff out which one is the fake news, the fake science news. Kara, you just told us you're still reeling from your solo loss last week.
That's true.
We'll see if you can do better this week. Here we go. Three regular news items, no theme. Mm-hmm. Item number one, researchers find that after the legalization of medical marijuana in Pennsylvania, attitudes towards use became more accepting, tracking with an increase in recreational use. Item number two, astronomers find that Ganymede's internal magnetic field increases the intensity of low-frequency radio waves generated by Jupiter's magnetic field by a factor of 1 million.
1 million?
1 million waves. 1 million. Item number three, a new study finds that immigrants not only use less healthcare per capita than native-born, they may subsidize healthcare costs. That means they use less than the money they pay into the system. This is in the U.S., Bob, I don't think you've gone first in a while.
Legalization of marijuana in Pennsylvania, it all sounds reasonable, yeah. Attitudes became more accepting, yeah. And tracking with an increase in recreational, yeah, that sounds fine, maybe too fine. Something smells about that one.
Does it smell Let's like see. Weed?
Yeah. Oh, see, the second one. So now we've got Ganymede. So something about the internal magnetic field of Ganymede is increasing the intensity of low-frequency radio waves generated by Jupiter's magnetic field by a factor of 1 million? Wow. Well, let's see. Jupiter does have a pretty intense magnetic field. Not as intense as that thing Evan was talking about, but pretty intense. I'm not buying that. And then the third one, yeah, immigrants are much better than we thought. Oh, who'd figure? So, yeah, I'm totally buying that one. So, yeah, I think Ganymede, yeah, what the hell? I mean, all right, so screw that. Yeah, I'll say that. I'll say that the marijuana in Pennsylvania is baloney. That's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Okay, so the one about the medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. So you're saying that the attitude towards it has become more accepting, tracking with increase in recreational use. Okay, that's interesting. I'm not so sure that recreational use is going up, but let's continue to this next one. This one about Ganymede's, astronomers find that Ganymede's internal magnetic field increases the intensity. Wow, like low frequency radio waves. And how could it do that? I wonder if you could use the moon to broadcast your like radio station. Okay, you know, I'm reading this and I'm thinking about it, and it seems a little
off the charts. I mean, you know, a million times is a huge increase. Last one, new study finds that immigrants not only use less health care per capita than native-born, they may subsidize health care costs. How do immigrants get into the health care system where they're paying for health care? You know, possibly through their jobs? I don't know
what
enough
do you mean?
Like, how does an immigrant – like
you
an immigrant
have to be a citizen to get health care.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like they become gainfully employed and they're paying for the health care through their employer.
Or they just buy it on the market, on the open market, on the open exchange.
Yeah. So the real thing is that they're just not using as much health care, which is what means that it's being subsidized. Well, you know what? I'm going to GWB because of certain things that make me not agree with this that I may or may not have read about this particular pharmaceutical. I'm going to GWB 72% of the time.
All right, Evan.
Wise move, Patrick.
Reverse order here. The study about immigrants using less health care per capita and also perhaps subsidizing health care costs. I think that one is right. I think it's more of a function of age than it is anything else. Generally speaking, in healthcare situations, younger people don't need as much healthcare, and they do wind up paying more for the elderly. The second one about Ganymede, so it lines up at Jupiter in a certain way in which it increases its magnetic radio waves generated by Jupiter's field, winds up going up by a million. Seems like a large number, but I think that's plausible. I don't see a problem with that. That kind of leaves left in the lurch over here, the marijuana in Pennsylvania. I thought recreational use of the drugs were basically down ticking, but I think that's more of a national number than maybe just this one state. But I don't buy it. Not quite sure exactly the exact reason. It just seems a little fishy to me. So I will go with Bob and Jay. And say
thank
that
you.
That's the one. Fiction.
All right, Kara, this time I let you go last. Did that help you?
Of course it did, because I'm not going to be out on my own now. Immigrants not only use less health care per capita than native-born, they may subsidize these health. I don't think this is a new study. I mean, it is a new study because he wrote that it's a new study, but I think it bolsters previous data because I think it's a common argument made against immigration, and it's not an argument that holds water that immigrants come in and, like, I don't know, use up all our health care or some crazy thing. So that one I'm pretty sure that I historically knew to be science. I don't understand the Ganymede one at all. I get it. I get what you're saying. I would not know how to reason through this one.
That's a hard one.
And the legalization of marijuana one, I think I'm actually going to disagree with you, Evan, that marijuana use is down nationwide. I don't think that's true. I could be wrong.
Well, I think it was recreational drug use, maybe not marijuana specifically.
Drug use, gotcha.
I think overall, I thought it was down.
I think marijuana use is up, but I also think that Colorado, when they legalized recreational marijuana, I think use went down, which makes no sense. But I remember reading that.
It's not legal anymore. Oh, I ain't doing that.
Exactly. I don't know. It's like, oh, I got to pay taxes on this. I don't know. So I would think that if that were the case in Colorado, maybe it would also be the case in Pennsylvania, although that is different because this is medical versus recreational. I'm trying to think of my own state, California, where medical has been legal, I think, as long as I've lived here. And it's like people who smoke pot, and people who don't smoke pot don't go, oh, I can buy it at the pharmacy now. I'm going to start smoking pot. So I think that that one is also the fiction for those reasons.
All right. So you're all in agreement. We'll take these in reverse order like you guys did. We'll start number three. A new study finds that immigrants not only use less health care per capita than native born, they may subsidize health care costs. You all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Yay. Is it because of what Evan said, that they're younger? Or is it because of, like, cultural stuff with going to the doctor?
It's not because they're younger, because this is true even across age groups.
Huh.
So this was – the reason why this is familiar to you, Kara, is because this was a review and meta-analysis of previous studies. So, yeah, it should reflect the findings of previous studies. They reviewed 188, in fact. They included 188 studies in this systematic review.
Wow.
And they found that – immigrants use between 1/2 to 2/3 of the healthcare expenditures as U.S.-born natives across all age groups. And this is still true even if you only include immigrants who have health insurance. So, because obviously if you have health insurance, you're going to use more healthcare.
Do you think that it's culture bound, that in more kind of non-Western societies, people just tend to be less likely to go to the doctor?
I think just on average, they're a lower risk group. So it's not necessarily that they're avoiding
service. Yeah.
Because generally speaking, avoiding healthcare tends to be expensive in the long run.
I know that you see it, though, with mental health services sometimes. I think it depends, but with like multicultural services, that there are certain cultural or ethnic groups, there's more of a stigma of like going to see a psychiatrist. So I don't know if there's like, if that translates to a physician, maybe not.
Yeah, but they said it may be the healthy immigrant effect.
Yeah, so that is kind of similar to what Evan said, less about age, but more about the fact that if you're going to come all that way.
So though they did say that the disparity tends to decrease as the immigrants get older.
Yeah, so they're eating French fries.
Yeah.
They're a culture.
Come on, maybe.
Seriously. Well, that and everybody as they get older require more. They have more chronic
that's just
illness.
The way it goes.
I'm going to get healthier.
Well, okay.
But that breaks a common narrative in this country that, focusing on immigrants, using up all of our resources. They contribute more than they take. That's been shown in many many studies.
South Park.
I know. That's why I'm laughing.
All right. Let's go to number two. Astronomers find that Ganymede's internal magnetic field increases the intensity of low-frequency radio waves generated by Jupiter's magnetic field by a factor of 1 million.
What?
1 million.
There's a lot to parse there. Yeah. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science. Good job, guys.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, we sniffed out the marijuana one.
So what is it, Steve? What's happening?
How could the little...
So this was tricky. This was tricky. This was definitely one where the press release and the reporting was so superficial I could not understand what the hell was going on.
I
had to go to the original study, and it was actually easier for me to slog through the jargon than read the freaking press releases I actually had a much better idea what was going on trying to understand or parse this technical article than the stupid reporting on it, which was so, I don't know, just was so superficial. They didn't really explain anything. But anyway, so I didn't know that Ganymede had a magnetic field of all of its own. That's interesting. And there's another moon of Jupiter also has a magnetic field. You guys want to guess which one? Nope.
Io?
That's a good guess, but no.
Isn't Io the volcanic one?
Yes. It's Europa. Europa. It's Europa. It's Europa.
Oh, it is Europa.
But Europa has an induced magnetic field. So in other words, Jupiter's magnetic field induces a magnetic field in Europa. But Ganymede has an internal magnetic field. It's generating one all on its own.
Got a little iron core there.
So I can't pretend to fully understand what's going on because they do get very technical here.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better.
No, absolutely. This is, they get into the maths, it was a technical paper written for physicists and astronomers. But what's apparently happening is, so Jupiter's magnetic field is interacting a lot. It's interesting, Evan, that you brought up with your rogue planet item that it has an aurora, but not from the solar wind. Well, Jupiter interacts a lot with its own particles as well. So that is not entirely new to this rogue planet. In fact, Jupiter, the most important particle interaction that happens on Jupiter comes from where? Bob, you should know this.
Wait. Charged particles not from the solar wind. Oh, galactic cosmic rays?
No, Io. Io is dumping out ions.
Why
it's called Io?
Because
from
why? Because all the activity, all the volcanic activity. And that's feeding, charged particles into the Jovian system. And then those particles get accelerated. Also, part of that interaction is generating low frequency waves in the radio frequency. So that's a known phenomenon. And then when they interact with Ganymede, however, they found that they get intensified. So the frequency doesn't change, but the amplitude of the waves change. The intensity changes. And they were surprised to find that it changed by 6 orders of magnitude or a million times. So that's incredible. But it's very, very localized. It's like you have to be, I think, within 2 diameters, 2 radii of the moon, of Ganymede. So it's only right in the vicinity of Ganymede are the waves that intense.
Sweet spot.
Interesting. So, but it made me wonder though. I wonder because we talked in our interview with Sean Carroll, which you missed, Bob, about radio communication. Like, why would aliens spend the energy to send out radio waves for other people to listen to? Well, what if we could use like Jupiter's magnetic field to magnify a radio signal that we're sending and by a million times? What, you know, then maybe we could send out a signal that could then communicate over vast distances because we're getting a massive energy boost from a natural magnetic source, right? Or park your radio transmitter next to a magnetar.
Well, yeah, that'll do it.
Whatever. That's the thing. We part of my point was we can't, it's so, you know, we can't even speculate. I think there's just so many possibilities that, you know, that too many variables to know about. But anywho, all this means that researchers find that after the legalization of medical marijuana in Pennsylvania, attitudes towards use became more accepting, tracking with an increase in recreational use. That is the fiction. What the study actually showed was that attitudes did improve towards the use of marijuana, but it did not result in an increase of use. Mm. So they said, yeah, it's fine to use it, but they still were choosing not to at the same rate. So it didn't track with an increase. So it doesn't appear to be affecting youth use of marijuana. That's what
I'm relieved.
No, so then of course that's a legitimate concern, right? That's often a point that is raised with legalization, is that it's going to turn marijuana into the next alcohol, you know, because, I mean, they're different, but part of, you know, alcohol is more of a health and social problem than every other recreational drug combined, like by an order of magnitude. Yep. And it's like the one legal one. And so, but I mean, it's also, I think, because there are pharmacological differences with alcohol. Alcohol is just more dangerous than marijuana.
Of course.
But yeah, it is certainly a legitimate question. What is the role of its legality playing in the fact that it causes, you know, so many social and health issues? It's also that it's
what,
cultural.
Alcohol?
Yeah, alcohol. It's cultural.
Of course,
too.
It's cultural. We tried to ban it. It didn't
I know.
Work.
Right, right. It's just so embedded in the culture.
It did work at first.
Like, what did somebody say at some point? Like, it's impossible to find a country western song that doesn't glorify the use of alcohol in some way. Right, there was some country singer who was like, you know, you can't sing country music without, you know, romanticizing alcohol. It just goes with the culture.
But you're right; it is a lot more.
It's huge. It's huge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, good job, guys.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Bob.
Swept me this
time, folks.
But that means that the stats haven't changed since last week.
That's right. So if you're competitive, then yeah, that didn't help you. Evan, do you have a quote for this week?
I do have a quote for this week, and it was suggested by SGU listener Rick Keneally. Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it. The true believer syndrome merits study by science. What is it that compels a person, past all reason, to believe the unbelievable? How can an otherwise sane individual become so enamored of a fantasy, an imposter, that even after it's exposed in the bright light of day, he still clings to it. Indeed, clings to it all the harder. No amount of logic can shatter a faith consciously based on a lie. And that was written by M. Lamar Keene and Alan Spraggett, who are the authors of the book The Psychic Mafia.
Mm-hmm.
Remember The Psychic Mafia?
Oh, yeah.
That is on my to-read list. Shame on me that I haven't read it yet. But it is a classic tale of skepticism, essentially.
Yeah. And that quote is an accurate description of a lot of what we deal with, like flat earthers, or I think the poster child this year of, you know, how could people believe, you know, like it's so unbelievable, it deserves an explanation. Like, we need to, you know, the notion that people in the 21st century can believe the earth is flat is just, you know, I will never be comfortable with that idea. Ugh.
Who let out the groan?
That was Bob. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dr. Steve.
You got it, brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.